Every revolution starts in the minds of the people. Arm yourself for the war of ideas. Take back your life. Take back your liberty. Tom Mullen talks freedom.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Tom Mullen Talks Freedom. Today, John Ziegler returns to the podcast. He is the host of the Death of Journalism podcast and was also previously the host of With the Benefit of Hindsight, which we're going to talk a little bit about, both of those. He's also a documentary filmmaker. He's been the host of hit radio shows. He's done it all and great presence on Twitter. I encourage you to follow him. John, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Now, the last time you were here, I got to think it was about early 2022. And you had just a few months back completed your podcast series With the Benefit of Hindsight. And for everybody who doesn't know, this was a very extensive look at the Jerry Sandusky Penn State scandal, wherein Jerry Sandusky was convicted of many counts of child sexual assault. The Penn State administrators, well, everyone knows Joe Paterno was fired as head coach right before his last game. And several administrators actually ended up going to jail. And as shocking as this sounds for everyone who doesn't know about the podcast, John, in my opinion, has proved beyond any reasonable doubt that not only did the administrators and Joe Paterno not cover up Jerry Sandusky's crimes, but Jerry Sandusky did not commit any crimes. It was all kind of a money grab hoax, and a very unjust one at that. And John, your podcast has 18 episodes, 18 or 19, I believe. They're all a couple hours long. Some are 2 hours. At least one of them is over 4 hours. I just listened to the whole thing again, and maybe that makes me crazier than anybody in this whole story. But I just couldn't stop. And of course, I was appalled the more I listened, just as I was the first time. And, you know, this came on the heels of everything I saw during what I call Coronasteria. I guess one thing, it's kind of affecting the way that I look at the world, the way I look at my fellow Americans. And before I talk about what I think about it, let me ask you, has your view of mankind or the American population changed since you started that journey?
Well, first of all, thanks so much for listening not once, but twice. I congratulate you on doing that, because while it is an extraordinary endeavor and I think a great podcast, it is a heavy lift because there's a lot to it. Although when you get invested in it and you get deep into it, a lot of people say that they are completely enthralled and can't stop listening. So I guess I can understand how that would happen, but that's still a remarkable achievement on your part. And thank you for coming to the conclusion that you did, which is also not unusual for people who have listened to the entire podcast. I would say almost everybody who's listened to the whole podcast comes to the same basic conclusion, which is, shockingly enough, Jerry Sandusky was innocent, and it's not even close. And that's kind of been my mantra for the last, I don't know, 8 or 9, 10 years since I came to this conclusion. I did not believe that at the beginning of the whole Penn State Joe Paterno quote-unquote scandal, which broke back in November of 2011. It took me a couple of years before I finally concluded, after an extraordinary investigation, which included two very, very extensive in-prison interviews with Jerry Sandusky and probably hundreds of other people, that this case was based in a fraud. And it's not a conspiracy at all. In fact, I always say the conspiracy theorists in this case are those that believe in the conventional wisdom. We were told to believe in a nonsensical conspiracy cover-up for which there was no logic nor any evidence. And the way that I like to look at this is, we all just accepted that the math on the Jerry Sandusky part of this story was correct. No one ever checked the math on that. We just accepted that, and we went right to the whole Joe Paterno Penn State cover-up part of this. Well, I checked the math. The math doesn't add up. It doesn't even come close to adding up. And like I said, if people listen to the podcast with the benefit of hindsight, they will come to the same conclusion. To answer your question, yes, this process, which has been extraordinarily arduous, very draining, beyond depressing at times, has absolutely changed my view of humanity, although I had a pretty dim view of humanity to begin with. So I'm not sure how much lower it could go. But one of the many reasons why I urge people to listen to With the Benefit of Hindsight is you're not just going to learn about this remarkable and fascinating and infuriating case that was one of the biggest stories of this century in America. You're going to learn a lot about humanity. You might not like what you learn, but you're going to learn a lot about humanity. And it's interesting to me that you brought up COVID, because to me, the COVID panic, as I refer to it, is probably the only big break that I have gotten when it comes to trying to convince people of what happened in the Jerry Sandusky Penn State story. Because at least in my experience, especially when I'm talking to libertarians or conservative-minded people, I now have a real-world experience that I can point to rather effectively and say, hey, you know what this case is like? This is a lot like what happened with COVID. The only difference is COVID was real. It was just remarkably exaggerated, and there was a moral panic and a political agenda and all sorts of other insane things that happened. Jerry Sandusky's sex abuse was not real, but the hysteria that surrounded both of those stories and the way that human beings reacted to them, and specifically the way the media reacted to both of them, was remarkably similar. So that has been a real entry point for me, at least with a portion of the population. If you get what happened now with COVID, you're going to understand what happened with Jerry Sandusky, Penn State, and Joe Paterno a heck of a lot more easily than you would have prior to spring of 2020, because they were remarkably similar dynamics.
Yeah, and it's funny because for you, the Sandusky thing happened first, and for a long time, for like a decade, well, not quite a decade, but 7-8 years, and then COVID. For me, I had no idea that you were out there working on this. I remember when the Sandusky scandal happened, and honestly, I was a fan of Penn State when they won those championships in the 80s, but I had stopped watching college football. I really stopped watching even NFL football. At the time, I was living in Tampa, and I was traveling all the time. And I said, look, I got time for one sport. And I just watched the hockey because it was always my favorite. And all of a sudden, this thing breaks. And the first thing I said was, Joe Paterno still the coach of Penn State? This is like 30 years later. I had no idea he was still there. And then Jerry Sandusky, I had never heard of this guy and whatever. And then it went away. And then you worked on it for 8 years, and then COVID happened.
By the way, not to interrupt you, Tom, but I think that since the timing for me was in reverse, the Penn State case, or the Sandusky case, whatever you want to call it, really helped me to sift through what was happening with COVID a lot more quickly than I think almost anybody else. I was much more well equipped to interpret what was happening with COVID because I felt like I'd already been through it with the whole hysteria surrounding Penn State and Joe Paterno and Jerry Sandusky.
Yeah. And there's so many things racing through my mind about this, but the one thing, as far as my first question, so I'm a libertarian, you're a conservative. I actually wrote a book about what the differences are between not only those two, but the people we now call liberals. And I do believe there's three separate ways of looking at the world. And while I wouldn't argue that libertarians, actually in the book, and if you read Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and I don't want to get too far down this road, they believe that people are angels, actually, and it's just private property that corrupts them. But conservatives believe that man is very, very savage, and that savagery must be controlled, whether it's by longstanding tradition or government power, whatever. And I would describe a libertarian saying, look, we know they're capable of that, We think they're capable of great good, and that incentives matter. And I know incentives are a big part of the Benefit of Hindsight podcast. You talked about it a lot. And I guess the reason I brought all this up is my view has dimmed considerably in the last, being hit with COVID. And I, right from the start, I was like, what are you talking about? Shut the country down? Are you out of your mind? And then I heard your podcast and I just thought, yeah, these are the same people. And you're talking about people going on ESPN and other networks who have no idea of a single fact of the case, just immediately condemning whatever the Loch Ness monster is, as you put it in your podcast, a great analogy. And I just see it everywhere now. And to me, Ukraine is the same thing. Whatever you think about the Ukraine war, you know, everybody having the Ukraine flag on their profile pic, I'm just thinking, what, you people couldn't even find Ukraine on a map. So it's really
There's a mob mentality that took over all of those stories, and it was driven largely by a fundamentally broken news media. I do a twice weekly podcast now called The Death of Journalism. So this is an area that I have great passion and I think an extraordinary amount of experience and expertise in. And the media drove the bus on both these stories. And what's interesting about the COVID and Sandusky comparison is that, you know, in the modern era, the media has lost a lot of power. I mean, we've seen that with the way that Donald Trump has been able to endure unprecedented negative media coverage. However, the media can still have enormous influence when two things are at play, at least two things. And those two things are, they're all working together in a very dramatic way in their, what they perceive to be in their own self-interest. So if they all are on the same team and they're all working together and they all have something, a story as a high priority, and the subject matter of that story is something with which the average person has very little or maybe even no experience with, then the media can have enormous influence. And that's what happened with Penn State, because, you know, even though there was the Catholic Church scandal, most people have had, especially at that time, had very little experience. There would never have been a child sex abuse scandal involving a man and boys involving big time college football before. This, you know, there had never been a story like this in college football or even big time college sports. So this was brand new and people had no experience to compare it to. And therefore, when the media went bananas and all worked together in a very high energy, passionate way with no concern for the other side of the story at all, none. This was one dimensional, one side only. If you were on the other side, you're a bad person. Well, the same dynamic took place with COVID. None of us had ever experienced a global pandemic like this before, so we had nothing to compare it to. See, the media has very little impact over Trump because we've all lived through multiple presidential elections. We all know, you know, the media has their political biases. We're prepared for that. We've lived through that. But we did not, had not lived at that point through a global pandemic, and the media reaction was exactly the same. All on one side, working together, enormous intensity of coverage, and only one side is allowed to be told. If you're on the other side, you're a bad person. In Sandusky, you're pro-pedophilia. In COVID, you're pro-virus. You're pro-people dying if you're not in favor of mandating masks for kids in schools. Something crazy, or even, you know, if you're somehow in favor of keeping schools open. That's the level of insanity this got to. And so that's really at the core of the comparison, not just of what happened with COVID and Penn State, but also why it is that Penn State and Joe Paterno and Jerry Sandusky scandal happened the way that it did. It was driven by a broken news media, a media that does not care about the truth, does not have expertise anymore, does not have the time to actually find out what the facts are before they decide to grab on, latch onto a narrative. And once they get a narrative that they like, Tom, whether it's Penn State or COVID or whatever it is, once the media gets a narrative they like, look out, because there's no stopping it. There's no reversing it. And in both COVID and Penn State, they put so many chips down, to use a gambling analogy, they put so many chips down on that one side instantaneously, there was no room for them to backtrack. Because for them to reverse would be to admit that they were catastrophically and fundamentally wrong. And they'll never do that. They will only reverse themselves and admit when they're wrong on smaller issues, and they have to do so almost immediately. You know, we saw with Jussie Smollett, for instance. You know, that was a clear case. The Jussie Smollett case was obvious to anybody with a brain that was a hoax, fraud from the beginning. The media pretended as if it was real, but they only did so for a week or two. They didn't completely buy into it. It was easy for them to admit, well, you know what, this probably wasn't true. We're going to move on very quickly, and we're not going to really focus on this as much as we should, because we don't like this story that it turned out to be a fraud and a hoax. But there weren't as many chips down, and there wasn't as much damage done. You would think, it's counterintuitive, you would think the more damage that was done in a situation, COVID, obviously enormous damage, Penn State, enormous damage to real lives and to innocent people. You would think the more damage that was done by a false story, the greater the impetus would be to correct it. But it doesn't work that way. It actually works the opposite way. The more damage, the more blood on the hands of the media, the less likely they ever are to acknowledge and admit that they were wrong and try to fix it. And that's been exceedingly frustrating for me in this entire journey.
Yeah. And, you know, when you were saying this wasn't a conspiracy on the part of the accusers and the prosecutors and everything, you said it was all these incentives that lined up. Well, once you have, blown up the world and now it's gone bad, of course, you don't want to say, well, that was my fault. Where is your incentive? Especially when, yeah, all of your fellow media people are in the same boat. And let me ask you this, the death of journalism. So it seems to be premised on the idea, and I think this is a fair take from listening, even to a benefit of hindsight, that, there was a time when the media was better. And let me throw something at you that I'm not saying is dogma, but just so you can respond to it, that the media was never any better, that they were always advocacy, that they were always telling one side of the story, and that it wasn't until the internet that people could start calling them out. And, there's a lot of nonsense on the internet, but at least there's an ability to call them out. And I'll give you some examples, like covering up Stalin's atrocities well before World War II and any incentive because of the alliance. But, the New York Times, of course, covered that up. The American people then were never told about that's one. And going through the 20th century, pretty much liberal advocacy throughout, I want to say that they seemed, at least under the pretense of being more objective, were they better, or do we just know what they're like now? What do you think?
That's a great question, and it's one that I've thought a lot about. And my take on it is that the media was never remotely perfect, because human beings are not perfect. However, going to a point you've already made, I'm big into incentive structures. And the incentive structures for the news media were, for a period of time, far, far better than they are today. And I would pinpoint probably the 60s through the early 90s of the 20th century as a time period where the incentive structure was the most sound. Wasn't perfect, and the media wasn't perfect. And was the media liberally biased? Absolutely. And does the, what I found out in the Penn State Joe Paterno Jerry Sandusky case make me wonder, are there other cases that we don't even know about that we just believe in that are complete bullcrap? Yeah, I'm open to that. But what happened in the 60s through the early 90s is that technology emerged and television emerged in such a way as to make owning a news media outlet effectively a license to print money. If you owned a TV station, a local TV station, a network affiliate, a radio station in any kind of major market, or a newspaper in any sort of major market, not even a major market, if you owned any of those entities during that time period, it was a license to print money. And what that meant was that because the culture still valued journalism at that time, or at least pretended to, that there was a firewall, a legitimate firewall between commercial interests of the news, of the outlet, the media outlet, and those that were doing journalism or news. And so these outlets had almost unlimited resources to spend on real journalism, because real journalism costs money. I mean, it's a miracle that I found, you know, the truth of the Penn State Joe Paterno Jerry Sandusky case. I did it for free, right? If I had been at a journalistic institution, this would have been beyond prohibitive with regard to the costs, even during the heyday of the news media. And especially today, nobody's going to spend money going down a rabbit hole that they don't know for sure is going to produce great results. And by the way, the great results aren't finding a truth that nobody knows or maybe won't like. The great results are finding a story that's going to get good traction or ratings or views, or is going to be commercially viable. The truth is not the coin of the realm. Popularity is the coin of the realm. But in that era of the 60s through the 90s, I would say from the Kennedy assassination through the mid 90s, when, you know, cable news started to really take off, Fox News Channel, became a major entity. That's when fragmentation started to change the business model and started to change the incentive structure. And so while I have absolutely no problem with those who say, well, wait a minute, John, it was never perfect, and the media was very liberally biased, look what happened to Nixon. You know, I actually think that if you know, Watergate happened today, I mean, heck, it wouldn't even register on the radar. Because for a lot of reasons. One, because we're way more desensitized, and two, because Fox News Channel and talk radio and the internet would be supporting Nixon the way that, you know, they would Trump in this day and age, and his approval rating wouldn't have plummeted to 29% or whatever it was, and Barry Goldwater wouldn't have been forced to say, hey, you know, you got to go. So that whole history would have been very, very different. But when I look at, okay, what time period would I like to go back to? I always say 1984, and it's not because of George Orwell. But in 1984, other than the fact that there was no Golf Channel, which, you know, stinks for a golf fan like me, the Golf Channel, I like the fact that that exists. But the media landscape, although I have problems with the Golf Channel too, from a journalistic standpoint, I'm just saying from the perspective of being able to watch golf, you know, whenever I want to. But in 1984, you know, the media was liberally biased, but it was substantive. And in 1984, Ronald Reagan won a massive landslide reelection victory. And so to me, you know, that was the time period when I would pinpoint as, okay, the media was at least somewhat fair there. They were substantive. And this is the most important part, Tom, because there was not yet major fragmentation, the average American was forced to consume legitimate news, even if it was a little liberally biased. They at least were forced to consume legitimate news, and there was no internet to provide nut jobs with the idea that these conspiracy theories that have overtaken so much of our culture are actually true. There were conspiracy theories, but they, people that believed in them, weren't enabled by going online and seeing that a tweet that pretended to have evidence that they were right had, you know, 500,000 views and a couple thousand retweets or whatever it is. So social media and the internet, I think, has caused us to lose an enormous amount of our population, including an enormous amount of conservatives and Trump supporters, in my view, who are living in a delusional world where conspiracies are commonplace. I mean, Tucker Carlson, a guy I used to have a lot of respect for, and I know a little bit, worked for him briefly, you know, has become a complete nut job in the conspiracy realm, believing all sorts of nonsensical things that are very, very popular now among the so-called Republican base or conservative movement. I don't even know, what you call it anymore in Trump world. And so, you know, I think that I would go back to the 1980s. We can't do that now. But, you know, that to me was an era where the media was biased, but it was substantive. And this is the last thing I'll say in this, conservatives have really deluded themselves into believing that the breakup of the mainstream monopoly was good for their side politically. I suggest that if, when you look at presidential history and when Rush Limbaugh became a major national figure and Fox News Channel started to have major influence basically at the same time period in the 1990s, if you start from 1992 when Bill Clinton defeated George Herbert Walker Bush for that presidency, the Republican results in presidential elections are horrendous. Horrendous. And if George Bush hadn't barely beaten, can you imagine if George Bush had not barely beaten Al Gore in 2000, which would have meant he was not reelected in 2024? My God, the history, we would not have had one Republican elected since 1988 for all this, because I don't count Trump as an actual Republican. So, and that's, you know, correlation is not causation, but I think that there is a causation between the fragmentation of the media, because here's what's happened. Conservatives have created their own silo where they have no ability to have their voice heard among the mainstream or, you know, moderate voters. Moderate voters are not watching Fox News Channel or, you know, going on the internet and going to right-wing websites or spending a lot of time on Twitter, you know, following right-wing influencers. They're not doing that. So now the left, you know, even though the mainstream is far less dominant, far less powerful than it used to be with far, you know, smaller audiences, the mainstream media doesn't even care about being fair anymore because they don't have to, because they have no conservatives in their audience. In the 80s, they did. They couldn't offend them because they would lose too much of their audience. Well, now they've already lost that audience. So now they've just let their hair down and they've become as left wing as they want to be. And so I actually think that conservative or right wing media is the worst thing that's happened in my lifetime to Republican candidates. And
I have never heard anyone say anything like that. And it, I hate to say it, makes a lot of sense. I mean, of course, the things that are running through my mind is, well, look, at a freer market has got to be better, but I can't help you say 1984. That's got to be very close to the year that the very much shared interview with Phil Donahue and Milton Friedman on Donahue's show. I you know, think about it. A guy like Milton Friedman could get a hearing, a long hearing, a respectful hearing, without any attack, and that could never happen today.
William F. Buckley had a major television show on PBS. William F. Buckley. Think about that. I mean, William F. Buckley was reaching enormous numbers of non-conservatives in a way that was seen as highly intelligent and very credible. That doesn't exist today. That will never exist again, especially now in the Trump world where conservatives have been painted as whack jobs, and understandably so. I know that you've probably never heard anyone else say it, but I will go to my death believing that, and I can defend it with a lot of facts and logic. And it's very frustrating to me. And, you know, just to put a little bit more meat on that bone, like, think about all the, you know, even back in the 80s and 90s, I mean, there were a lot of mainstream reporters and anchors who we later found out were pretty conservative once they were forced to go to Fox News Channel. People like Britt Hume or John Stossel, or, you know, I mean, there are other people in of that ilk who I wish their voices were still being heard by a quote unquote mainstream audience instead of being forced to go into the right-wing media. And I'm just using those two as examples. There's many others that are more recent than that. But, you know, that seems to be a normal thing where, you know, someone will eventually lose their job in the mainstream and then we'll realize, oh, okay, they were actually conservative. And now they're living off the land on Fox News Channel or somewhere else, Newsmax, what have you. But that's not productive to the conservative cause or to educating middle of the road voters about the dangers of liberalism. And so, yeah, I feel pretty strongly that, you know, give me 1984 and the Golf Channel and maybe, you know, maybe ESPN back in its heyday. But the ESPN, it was already existing at that point. So but not in 18 different channels. So anyway, that's where I am on that.
So everybody's kind of now split into these silo. What's happening is everyone's being told what they want to hear. All the liberals are listening to CNN and NBC, yes. And they're it's hearing therapy. What they want to hear.
It's therapy.
And all the conservatives are listening to what they want to hear. But the problem is sometimes the truth is not what you want to hear. And nobody's telling them that. No one's telling either side that.
Well, and my life and my career are proof that can't work in the modern business model, because that's what I do. I tell both sides when they're full of crap, and my goal is always the truth. Now, does that mean I'm always right? No, but that's always my goal. And I think my batting average is way, way higher than anybody else, because I don't have any concerns about placating a particular audience. I don't care. And I referenced to you that it's basically become therapy. That's what the news media is. It's therapy. You know, it's give me the news of the day in a therapeutic fashion so that I can feel better about my already, you know, very ingrained worldview. And if I'm on the left, I'll go to, you know, the left wing networks. If I'm on the right, I'll go to the right wing networks, and I will feel better because they will tell me the truth I want to hear. And they will make sure that I don't have to hear anything that's going to make me feel bad. And therefore it's therapy. And that's that the truth is not the coin of the realm. Popularity is.
Well, let's talk about Trump for a minute, because you and I, from what I've seen on social media, have both been in the position of trying to defend due process, the Bill of Rights, the rule of law, to support this buffoon. And it's tough sometimes to parse between, look, I do not want this guy prosecuted for this nonsense and taken off the ballot. That's the only reason they're doing this. On the other hand, I have no intention for voting for him. I guess what I don't understand is Trump's voters are just completely devoted to him. And there's a lot more people who believe that, even if they don't think he's the greatest thing since sliced bread, that he is far better than the alternative, and that there's an urgent need to get Biden out of there and put Trump in the White House. So what he said on his initial campaign, I didn't even agree with all that or most of it. But when he got into office, let's just like do the laundry list. Okay, first of all, what were the big things that happened while he was in office? He ran on immigration. I don't know why the Republicans can't just ram through a repeal of the 1965 Immigration Act with no Democrat votes. They did that with Obamacare. It seems like, you know, they can never do anything when they get into office. They couldn't repeal Obamacare either when they had all the votes they needed, except for John McCain's, I guess. But what the big test to me was COVID. Trump went along with COVID. He signed the funding for it. And without that funding, it could never have happened. He funded Ukraine, which all the Republicans say that they're against doing now. Well, he did that. So I guess what I'm wondering is, why is the devotion still there? Like, what is it about this guy whose presidency would have looked, I can't think of how it would have looked different than what a Republican that they would call a rhino, Mitt Romney or whomever. Why are people still so devoted?
Well, I think there are a lot of reasons, but I think the one that gets the most underrated is what the 2016 victory over Hillary, and to a lesser extent, the victory in the Republican primary that year, meant to the Trump voter. See, the core Trump cult member is someone who, because they're not very well educated, has been made to feel bad about their intellect by the elites throughout their entire lives. And so 2016 offered them maybe the first time in their lifetimes where they said X was going to happen. The experts told them, no, X is not going to happen. Y is going to happen. And it turned out that X did happen. And Trump won the Republican nomination, and Trump beat Hillary. He defeated the Wicked Witch of the West. And there, that is a day that is kind of like a reverse 9/11 for Trump cult members. I mean, that is something that really, for many of them, made their lives. It was the highlight of their public life for Trump to defy the predictions of all the hated experts and the hated media. And by the way, you know who else was surprised by Donald Trump's 2016 victory? Donald Trump. Donald Trump had no expectation that he was going to win. He acted very much like a guy who, we've even found out some of the revelations in this criminal trial he's facing that, to me, are consistent with a guy who had no intention of actually winning, because the deals with the porn star and the Playboy playmate were ending after the election. So why would you do that if you thought you were going to win? But anyway, the point is that I think that the Trump cult member has eternal devotion to Trump because he's the Wizard of Oz. They think that, and I see him as the old man behind the curtain, but they still think he's the great and powerful Oz. and therefore, it doesn't really matter what he does. And I agree with your assessment of his record. In fact, I would be far more critical of his record. I think, you know, he got elected saying build the wall. He had every opportunity to build the wall. He didn't build a wall. We got a tax cut, and I will give him credit for standing by Brett Kavanaugh, and he got three pretty decently conservative Supreme Court justices. They weren't perfect, but, you know, I'll give him credit for that. Now, I don't think he deserves all the credit. I think actually Mitch McConnell deserves a lot more credit than Trump, but okay, you know, he nominated them. He stood by Kavanaugh when probably no one else would, when the whole bullshit Christine Blasey Ford thing happened. But other than that, it's really hard to point to any remotely long-term victories. And to me, COVID was basically, other than that, Mrs. Kennedy, how was the trip to Dallas? I mean, I really have absolutely no support or even sympathy for what Trump did during COVID, because I think it was worse than you even described. I mean, now, you know, Trump, in typical Trump fashion, he changed his position on COVID almost every day. I wrote about this for Mediaite as a senior columnist, and I don't know whether or not he was smart enough to do this by design or whether it was just because he was so confused and out of his league or whatever, but his cult will always go back and point to any particular statement that they like from that time period and ignore all the ones that aged exceedingly poorly. And I think Trump shit the bed on COVID. He abdicated his presidency to Dr. Fauci. He made Fauci a superstar. I mean, that was the worst mistake of his entire presidency. Trump especially should know, because this was his one area of expertise. Trump understands the media and he understands celebrity. You don't put Dr. Fauci on live television when the entire country is shut down and every network's going to carry it, and he's going to get nearly Super Bowl-like ratings, a megalomaniac like Dr. Fauci, and the media is going to lap up everything he says and make him into a superstar. Once he's a superstar, it's over, because he's effectively the dictator of the country. And Trump should have understood that. Trump didn't even need to fire Fauci. He just needed to get him off the fucking television screen. That was, I could not believe. And I knew this immediately. I mean, I knew not very little about Dr. Fauci at that time. The first time I ever saw him on television, I'm like, what is Trump doing? This guy is a nut. He is power hungry. And one of the many, many, many things the media just refuses to ever acknowledge or accept about Dr. Fauci is this was the greatest thing that ever happened to him. And so does he want the pandemic to go on for a long time? Or does he want it to go on for a short time? What is his self-interest? There is zero question that Dr. Fauci and people like him all over the country, the so-called experts, wanted this thing to go on as long as it possibly could, because it was the greatest thing that ever happened to them. Their lives were going to go back to normal when it was over. And so the fact that Trump couldn't see that and shit the bed and attacked Georgia for opening up first, I mean, that to me was... How in the world Donald Trump ever won the 2024 Republican presidential nomination without breaking a sweat after he incorrectly condemned the Republican governor of Georgia for opening up too soon, making it far more difficult for him and any other governor to do the same thing? And then, you know, after what happened in 2020, what he did to the Republican officials in Georgia claiming that the election was fixed when it wasn't in Georgia. How Trump ever survived that is really astonishing to me. But I am extremely critical of the way that Trump handled COVID. And to me, it's a disqualifier. I despise Joe Biden. I despise what's happening in the country. I am terrified of the whole wokeification of America. I think that Biden will not serve a second term. Kamala Harris, if Biden wins, will take over probably in the last 2 years so that she can still run for two full terms after that. I am as adamantly opposed to Joe Biden as anybody I know, but I am not at all confident that a second Trump term would be better. I really am not. And there's a lot of reasons. It's not just, you know, some people try to say, well, but John, he learned his lesson during COVID. Well, there's no evidence of that at all. He's never acknowledged. He changed his tune on COVID.
He's still campaigning that lockdowns were good. We had to do it. We saved millions of lives. He still did yesterday.
Right. He's made so many different statements. I mean, if you wanted to, you could do a mashup of Trump sounding like Ron DeSantis, and you could do a mashup of Trump sounding like Dr. Fauci. You absolutely could. You could do 5 minutes of highlights that make him sound like DeSantis and 5 minutes that make him sound like Fauci. And it wouldn't be difficult at all. So I have no evidence that he's learned his lesson, but it's way beyond that for me. No one can tell me who the hell is going to work in a second Trump administration. Who's going to be his Secretary of State? Who's going to be his Secretary of Defense? Who's going to do any of these incredibly important positions? We don't even know who his vice presidential nominee is going to be yet, which is an incredibly important position, given the fact of Trump's age and that he's termed out after this next term, should he win. We don't know anything. We don't know anything about what a second administration would be. The only thing we know is that his name wouldn't be Joe Biden. And so I'm not going to vote for either. I don't know who I'm going to vote for. I have no idea what I'll do there. Kind of depends on who the Libertarian candidate is. I'm not voting for RFK Jr. That's for damn sure, because I think RFK Jr. is nuttier than Trump and more of a socialist than Biden. But the reality is that a lot of conservatives are deluding themselves that somehow, you know, well, Trump is surely better than Biden. I am not convinced of that. There are some really bad things that could happen in a second Trump term. We just don't know.
He'll say better things, but there's no evidence he'll do better things. He did all the things that Biden would have done during COVID. So I'm with you. Well, I've kept you longer than I said I would. What's coming up on Death of Journalism? What are you looking at right now? And what's there some upcoming things you're going to be tackling?
Well, we talk obviously about the news of the day. So we've been discussing a lot of this craziness on college campuses with regard to the anti-Israel, pro-Hamas protesters. We also, on almost every episode, I do an update on what's going on in both the Trump trial as well as the presidential election with regard to the polling. I find the polling situation to be very, very interesting. I have some expertise in polling. I was a polling analyst many, many years ago for Quinnipiac University, and I've commissioned 3 major polls myself over the years. And I'm pretty decent about interpreting polling and coming up with, I think, mostly, except for 2016's general election, pretty good predictions about what's going to happen. And I actually think that we are not giving enough credibility, and the media is not talking nearly enough about the fact that we are really heading right now down the throat, or whatever you want to call it, down the hosel of the at gunpoint of a 269-269 electoral college tie. I don't think people fully understand how incredibly likely that is. All that has to happen in this presidential election for there to be a 269-269 tie is for Joe Biden to win all the northern swing states, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, which I think you can make a strong argument are going to be close, but he would be favored in. And Donald Trump wins all the so-called southern swing states, North Carolina, Georgia, Arizona, and Nevada, which he is currently winning all of those states outside the margin of error. And I think he is a heavy favorite to win right now. If the election was today, I think he would win all 4 of those states, North Carolina, Georgia, Arizona, and Nevada. If that happens, if everything I just said happens, which I think is the most likely scenario, we are on the cusp of a 269-269 tie, depending on what happens in Omaha, Nebraska. The entire election would come down to Omaha, Nebraska. And if Omaha, Nebraska's congressional district went for Trump, we would have a 269-269 tie, which would then go to the new House of Representatives. And by the way, we could easily not just have complete chaos because of how that House of Representatives election would go. If the U.S. Senate goes as it easily could, which would be West Virginia flips to Republicans and everybody else stays exactly the same, that's a very plausible scenario, maybe even probable scenario at this point, because I think Republicans are going to lose a lot, just like they did in 2022, a lot of close senatorial elections because of Trump. So if that happens, guess what we're looking at? We're looking at a situation that I can't even figure out reading the Constitution how this would go down, because the Senate would decide the vice president and the House would decide the president. In all likelihood, Trump would win the House election because each state would get one vote. But you could have a situation where Kamala Harris would cast the deciding vote in her own favor to be the vice president for Trump, because it would be 50-50 in the Senate. And I don't even know how that would work under those circumstances. No one's been able to tell me, and I don't know if there's an answer. We would have to go to the Supreme Court in all likelihood, because you'd have 50-50 tie in the Senate. And who would break that tie? Well, the current vice president would be Kamala Harris voting for herself, in theory. I mean, the level of insanity that would ensue under this scenario, I think, is a recipe for civil war. It's going to make January 6th look like a picnic. And this is not far-fetched. I mean, I'm telling you, if the election was today, based upon the current polling, the scenario I just outlined is, it might be the most probable scenario of any of them.
Wow.
And no one's talking about this.
I can't think off the top of my head. Has another presidential election been decided by the House since the first Jefferson term, or no?
No, No.
That's the only one, right? So. Yeah, I don't think so either. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Well, this is the kind of stuff you can hear, folks. The death of journalism. John, I hope this is cathartic for you, because as we've discussed, there's no market for the truth. So I hope you you stay with it.
I got a question for you, Tom. I got a question for you. Since you become so convinced that I'm right about Penn State, Joe Paterno, Jerry Sandusky, and have listened to With the Benefit of Hindsight twice, was there an aha moment that, or a fact that you heard, or an analysis that you heard in the podcast that made you finally go, you know what, Ziegler's right, this is clearly what happened here?
Well, the way you laid it out, it's kind of a build. The whole first episode's about the date being wrong, not once, but twice. Right. And as soon as I knew that Mike McQuarrie did not go to Joe Paterno the day after he saw whatever he saw, I was already like, well, what did he see then? And that was right. The whole basis of the case. So I'm probably more predisposed to think that this could be, you know, a wrongful prosecution. But I was like, gee, the amount of victims even now creeps into my mind. Well, there are 33 of them. I mean, I don't know. Couldn't one of them be telling the truth? You know, it's that's very powerful, that tool that prosecutors have. Just accuse this guy of everything, and
question that people put a lot of stock into the number of accusers, the idea that not everyone could be lying. And my thought is always, well, wait a minute, if you're accepting the fact that a bunch of them are lying, why can't they all be? They all have the same monetary self-interest, and none of them have any evidence or any logic to their story. And you put your finger, I think, and that's a great answer you gave, because you put your finger on what for me is the key to the case. And that's why we did the first episode and called it The Date. Once you understand the timeline, you understand that the so-called Mike McQuarrie episode did not happen the way that we were told it was. It's very clear that it did not. And once that is accepted as the truth, then the whole case falls apart. So your analysis is dead on.
Yeah. And I think for anybody who might go and listen to this, and I mean, really, it's just so compelling that The Date should have you already on board. Is all right, I got to listen to this now, because, you know, and then probably I'm looking over the episodes now. You spend some time on kind of how the panic built and how we were proving the original crime by trying to prove the cover up before we prove the crime. You know, if you don't have a crime, you can't have a cover up. Well, why are we trying to prove a cover up first? But by the time you get to the Aaron Fisher story, which is episode 6, and once I heard that, I was like, oh my God, forget it. I could see this. Here's one last thing about that that's also kind of just crept into my mind. Back in the 1990s, I worked for two insurance companies. I used to manage provider relations, and I had a big room full of mostly women who used to work in doctor's offices adjusting medical claims. And we did this thing every year where, I don't know how this is going to come off, and I don't care. We did this thing every year where we would do a toy collection, and the women that worked in the department would go and pass out the toys to, you know, underprivileged kids or whatever. And, we'd always have a new person, you know, coming, and they're all excited for this. And the people who had done it before would say, don't get too excited. This is not a real joyful thing, because they're expecting to be treated like Santa Claus. And it was a downer for them to do it, because the people would like not be grateful that they got the free toys, and they would actually complain about them and they'd take them. But it was just like a very, I don't know. And when I'm thinking about all these kids, and not about the kids themselves, but their parents, seeing dollar signs in their eyes and just being not very likable people. That just came into my head while I was listening.
That's, you know what, I can totally see where you're going with that. The way I would, translate that with regard to the significance, of being, you know, part of the, With the Benefit of Hindsight narrative is this. What I always like to say is, our entire system of evaluating sex abuse claims especially among so-called children, although there were no children that testified in this case. They were all adult men. People need to understand that. But the entire system for evaluating these kinds of claims is based in the idea that no one wants to be a victim. No one wants to be known as a victim, that there's a stigma to being a victim, and that therefore any such claim is inherently credible. Well, we've changed as a society. Being a victim is now the American dream. It's the American dream. And so, and your story kind of goes to that, where, you know, instead of being grateful for a handout, you're like, you feel so entitled. You're like, well, this toy is crap. You know, yeah. I mean, so that has been a fundamental change in our culture that people don't accept has a massive impact in a case like this, because it's all based, I can't tell you how much it is based on the idea, well, no man would ever publicly claim that they were sexually abused by another man. It's so humiliating. It's so embarrassing. Okay, really? In this case, you get total anonymity. The media doesn't even report your name. The trial was not on television. You're completely protected by the prosecution, by the media. The public doesn't even know who you are. You testify for a couple hours. Penn State doesn't vet your claims, and you get paid multi millions of dollars. You tell me that in this day and age that that's going to be a problem for a male who comes from a bad background and was probably abused themselves and doesn't have a job and you know, wants to spend money on sports cars and vacation homes, which is where all this money went. I mean, come on. That is not the world we live in anymore. We don't live in a world where people would have any concern or hesitation about taking advantage of the system if they were given the opportunity to do so, even if it meant claiming for 2 hours in court anonymously that they were sexually abused by an old man. So that's one of the fundamental misconceptions that led to this injustice, in my opinion.
Yeah. It's so ugly. And so many, it fuels my animosity towards the media, the moral part of it. Everything now is this moral crusade. And that certainly is different from the 20th century, that, it's either you accept what I just told you, or you're what's the list now? Transphobic, homophobic, white supremacist, whatever, you know, no matter how unrelated the issue might be to those things. So like I said, well, you've got one fan up here in Buffalo, New York. I know you got a lot more for this podcast, so I encourage everybody, listen right from the beginning. If you go to The Death of Journalism and go all the way back to episode one, at least when you're on Apple Podcasts, you actually start with the benefit of hindsight, and you can just go all the way through. John, I appreciate you being on, and hopefully you'll find some time to stop back again.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, friends, that's going to do it for today. Just a few reminders to stop by TomMullenTalksFreedom.com/support and check out all the ways that you can support my efforts here, including joining my Patreon or my Substack. And if you haven't already, make sure that you go to itsthefedstupid.com to download a copy of my free ebook, It's the Fed Stupid. And as always, if you like the music you've heard here on Tom Mullen Talks Freedom, you can hear more at TomMullenSings.com. Thanks for listening.
The War of Ideas has only just begun. Arm yourself with the knowledge you need by heading to TomMullenTalksFreedom.com and subscribing to our email list. And remember, every revolution starts in the minds of the people.